You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The situation may point, and I say may because I don't want to go to speculations and I don't want to go to assumptions like others, but if you analyze the situation properly, the possibility of having a terror attack is higher.
A plane went missing earlier today as it travelled from Paris to Cairo. How much do we really know about what happened, and how should it be reported? Also coming up, Beijing and Washington have fallen out over an incident in the disputed South China Sea. But should the US even be patrolling the region? And then...
I want to take the opportunity to be able to express directly to her my apologies for my behaviour and my actions, unreservedly.
Justin Trudeau has had to apologise for his part in a minor scuffle in Canada's parliament. Has it all been blown out of proportion? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Martin Plout, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, and Isabel Hilton, who's the editor of China Dialogue. Martin and Isabel, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
A passenger jet flying from Paris to Cairo went missing earlier today. It had just left Greek airspace when it disappeared suddenly from the radar. It's thought to have made two sharp turns before falling into the sea below. 66 people, mostly from Egypt and France, were on board. So what do we know about what happened, and how do you report such a tragedy responsibly? Martin, let's start with that first question so far. It's been a day of a lot of talking, but it's been a little unclear as to, so far, what has actually happened.
Well, different bits of information have come out from different people, from the from the Paris end, from the Cairo end, and from the Greeks, and all of them have had added little bits of information along the way. And the speculation from those sources, and these are sort of fairly legitimate sources now, appears to be that it is more likely to be some kind of terrorist act than a malfunction. But that is about as far as we know. Some of the debris has been seen in the sea. And obviously the point with this is, as a story like this unfolds, is you report only the things that you know about and try not to get into speculation. Unfortunately, of course, it is all too easy to get involved in speculation. But, you know, one just has to paint the picture as it is revealed.
Well, just to bring us entirely up to date, Egypt Air has just confirmed that they've found the wreckage near Kapathos Island. They say Egypt Air resource stated that the Egyptian Ministry of Civil Aviation has just received an official letter from the Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs that confirms the finding of the wreckage of the missing aircraft. Egypt Air sincerely conveys its deepest sorrow to the families and friends of the passengers on board flight MS-804. Isabel Hilton, again, one of the complications with understanding exactly what has happened with an event like this is that you have multiple sources that aren't necessarily all talking to each other, whether that is the authorities in Paris and the political, the politicians in Paris. We've heard from Francois Hollande and other ministers in his government today. We've also heard from Egypt Air and from the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, sometimes contradicting each other. We've also heard from the Greeks as well, because they've been involved, because it was in Greek airspace beforehand. It makes it very hard to work out who knows what they're talking about.
Well, it is very hard. And I think the most agonising case of this was the Malaysian airline, the airliner that disappeared and vanished.
MH370.
Yes, having described this extraordinary deviation from its route and so on. And at that point, you had, if you remember, a lot of Chinese passengers on board who became more and more convinced that there was a conspiracy, that they weren't being told, you know, that somebody knew something that they weren't being told. And that largely derives from the fact that they live in a system where they're often not told things, so it's very easy to assume that. The Malaysian Airlines were trying to be extremely responsible and only talk about what they knew. But what they knew, of course, came out in dribs and drabs, and what they learned was so bizarre that it simply made it all, you know, more and more strange. But none of the speculation, I mean, what everybody wants at that point is certainty. They want to know what they want to know if people are alive or dead, and mostly they want to know what happened. And you simply can't know that. And it's not just airlines. I remember the Oklahoma City bombing, where I was, as it happened, presenting a live news program on another station that night. And there was immediate, you know, it was a bombing. And immediately people began to speculate that this had to be a kind of terrorist attack, but a foreign terrorist attack, possibly Muslims involved. In fact, it was, you know, a mad right-wing American. So it is, you have to be extremely careful. And as soon as you get a political perspective involved, then everybody is saying things not because of what they know, but because of a marker they want to lay down.
And Martin Plout, particularly now, certainly compared to, you know, 20, 21 years ago when the Oklahoma City bombing took place, with 24-hour news channels and social media, the news industry isn't very good at reporting nothing, is it? I mean, it can fill lots of airtime reporting nothing, but it's not very good at saying, this is what we know so far and sorry, we can't add anything else.
Well, nature abhors a vacuum, and the public get bored after about 15 seconds if you're just clearly not telling them anything they didn't know beforehand. They just flip over to the next channel. So you have to try to keep the whole thing alive and give them at least the impression that you are on the ball. One of the interesting sources, which is always worth having a look at, is what's called PRUNE, or PRUNE, which is the Pilots Rumour Network, which is a closed site. You can't get onto it unless you are a pilot. And they put in there all sorts of information, technical information often, about the plane, about what it's capable of, about the area, and they are often hours before anybody else. They will show you the information. They showed, for example, the shape of the way in which the flight turned and then did this sort of spiral, it seems, downwards. Mm. So that's always one site that's well worth having a look at if you want to get ahead of the story.
Isabel Hilton, regardless of what the reason was for this incident, it will cause more problems, won't it, for Egypt and for Egypt's tourism industry. And tourism is a huge part of the Egyptian economy.
Yes, it will. Probably slightly less than the Sharm el-Sheikh plane, since this one originated in Paris. So it's going to be, you know, less, if you like, on the Egyptian security lapses, depending on what happened. There was, of course, the other Egypt Air flight in 1999, which flew out of JFK, crashed in the Atlantic. The black box never found. The US authorities concluded that the co-pilot had ditched the plane in the sea. And the Egyptian government simply flatly refused to accept that and said this is a mechanical failure. So the Egyptians, you know, clearly don't like to acknowledge, even where it seemed fairly convincing that something like that had happened, that it had happened. If something similar turns out to have happened on this occasion, I think it's going to be very, very tough to persuade anyone to fly in or out of Egypt.
Martin, you know, some in the Egyptian government won't, if it does turn out to be terrorism, they won't mind that as a reason, will they, given the situation in Egypt at the moment and the fact that Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is painting this picture that his country is at war with terrorism?
Well, yes, that would certainly play into the narrative. But I think Isabel has a point here, which in a sense, looking at the previous downing, which is that I suppose if one was going to speculate, the most likely involvement is, of course, with a member of crew, because they are less scanned than anybody else. So, I mean, you either had a catastrophic aircraft failure of the aircraft, or it's possibly the crew, because after all, everyone else in Paris would have been very carefully searched.
Isabel, what's striking about you know, all these incidents that have taken place in the last two or three years is that it hasn't stopped people flying. It may have stopped people, you know, it may have made people think twice about, well, do I want to go to Sharm el-Sheikh on holiday, or, you know, are there certain destinations I'm perhaps not so keen on? But the idea of flying, of, you know, going through an airport and getting on a plane, despite, you know, all the security you see at an airport, the fact that you'll see, you know, at most major Western airports, certainly anyway, police with the most astonishing weaponry, you know, you've ever seen outside of a war zone, you know, people are still prepared to fly, aren't they?
It is slightly bizarre. And it is in contrast. I remember when the first Gulf War started, coming back through Heathrow, and it was very, very quiet, and people did stop flying for a while. But I guess it's that human optimism that you think it's not going to happen to you. I think they may be avoiding certain airlines, however. Certainly Malaysian Airlines passengers dropped quite a lot after losing two planes in unfortunate circumstances.
Indeed.
Within a very short space of time. So I think that it does have effect, but perhaps not on the global numbers.
And I guess, again, talking about numbers flying, Martin Plaut, the fact that there were only 66 people on this plane, including crew, suggests that there has already been something of a hit towards not just tourism into Egypt, but people going for business as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, it's not such an attractive destination, although it has so many wonders to behold.
OK, we're going to move on. Punches, bottles of water and even a hard hat were thrown in the South African Parliament earlier this week as the firebrand opposition group, the Economic Freedom Fighters, were expelled from the chamber for trying to prevent President Jacob Zuma from speaking. The fight was sparked when the ANC's Zuma was denounced by the left-wing party as an illegitimate leader who should step down. The High Court ruled in March that the South African president had violated the constitution over the spending of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money on his private residence. Martin Plaut, the economic freedom fighters may not be playing by the rules of a parliament, but they've touched a nerve, haven't they?
Oh, they certainly have, and they do have a lot of support amongst younger South Africans, younger black South Africans, who really haven't gained from, or haven't gained very much economically from the ending of apartheid. And they just think, you know, we've been locked out of the system economically. That is, in a sense, why they have this name, the Economic Freedom Fighters. We've got political freedom, but not economic freedom. And so that they see Jacob Zuma as, who, of course, through Julius Malema, the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters, out of the ANC, they see him as illegitimate. Not so much because of Nkandla, which was his private villa, which he got done up by the state, but also because of the 780, I think it is, allegations of corruption that there are against, which have never been tested in court, and which are now the authorities are now mulling over whether they should bring them back, having dropped them once and being told they really can't just drop them. So there are a whole series of allegations against President Zuma, and for that reason, the EFF see him as illegitimate, and every time he tries to get up in Parliament, they make a massive row until they get thrown out by very heavy-looking bodyguards.
Isabel Hilton, the way democracy is supposed to work is that when a party has been in power for too long, or when a leader has become too unpopular, he or she or they can be thrown out at the next election. Now, part of the problem in South Africa, a new young democracy, is that one party is so overwhelmingly popular, and genuinely overwhelmingly popular, getting nearly two-thirds of the vote, that those sort of escape valves don't really exist in South Africa at the moment.
Well, it's not just that doesn't exist. I mean, part of the frustration of this incident is that the judicial processes are ineffective. So you do have 783 corruption charges against Zuma from his days as deputy president, but they never thrived. And that, you know, democracy is not just what happens in parliament, and it's not just what what happens in political parties. It's all the other things. It's the things that protect and defend the rights of the citizen in everyday life. It's the corrections of abuse, you know, outside the parliamentary chamber. And when that kind of frustration does build up, and indeed when a dominant party does not clean its own house, because, you know, you come to a point, well, if the system can't do this, then the dominant ruling party, to maintain its credibility, does need to have some kind of house cleaning mechanism. None of these things apply. So I suspect we'll go on getting these disorderly scenes until something gives.
Martin, on the issue of the ANC, do you think that there will come a moment? Yeah, as there was, you know, when Thabo Mbeki was president, they decided that, you know, things weren't going well and they got rid of him themselves. Do you think that the ANC might eventually get to a stage where they think, having Jacob Zuma as head of state isn't really working for us, it's going to affect the ANC's popularity, we need to get rid of him in the same way?
Well, yes and no. A very judicious answer, perhaps. I think the date you should ring is August the 3rd, because there are local elections in South Africa this year. If the ANC was to lose the Nelson Mandela Bay area, which is the area around Port Elizabeth, perhaps Gauteng, which is the area around Johannesburg, and maybe even Pretoria, which are possible. These are not certain. These are local government elections. But if they were to lose those and lose essentially some of the really substantial metropolitan areas to the Democratic Alliance, which, you know, it does have about 25 to 30% of the vote, if that happens, then it will be an absolute body blow to the ANC, and then they will begin thinking seriously about replacing Jacob Zuma. Already the ANC in the Johannesburg area has muttered that he really should go. But the problem with that is that Jacob Zuma has populated key sections of the ANC so prolifically with his own people, and particularly with Zulus, who are the majority tribe in South Africa. And, you know, though people don't like talking about tribes, they play a heck of a role in South Africa. And, in those circumstances, where would the balance lie between the loyalists and the people who would want to get rid of him? And we'll only know that after August the 3rd.
Isabel Hilton, just finally on this point, there is then also the opposition of the issue of who is the opposition in South Africa. We've had the Democratic Alliance, as Martin mentioned, there have been the opposition essentially since the start of true democracy in South Africa, but have really struggled to be seen really as anything more than, you know, certainly not as a party that on the whole is seen as representing black South Africans. You've had COPE, which was a sort of a spin-off from the ANC, which didn't last very long. You've now got the Economic Freedom Fighters, which, as Martin was saying, was born out of Julius Malema being thrown out of the ANC himself. Where can you see the real opposition coming from within the democratic system in South Africa?
Well, I think it will continue to splinter off the ANC. I think that's really, in the short term, I think that's where it will come from. I don't think you can expect. I mean, if you look at other systems where you have a very dominant party over a long period, thinking of Spain post-Franco, thinking of Mexico, for instance, in the end, you do get a right-wing business party coming in. And the dominant parties have been, you know, as it were, social democrat parties of one sort or another. But that takes a long time. And I think I don't know South African politics that well, but it'd be clearly not strong enough at this point. And the other option is that you get a split in the party, in the ruling party, which is strong enough. Otherwise, it remains a one party state in effect.
Okay, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests Martin Plaut and Isabel Hilton. Coming up, were the Chinese justified in intercepting a US military plane in the South China Sea? And we'll discuss Justin Trudeau's scuffle in the Canadian Parliament. That's all still to come after this.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in studio, Martin Plaut and Isabel Hilton. The Pentagon says that Chinese fighter jets have carried out an unsafe intercept of a US military aircraft over the South China Sea. Washington said that the incident happened in international airspace earlier this week as one of its aircraft carried out a routine patrol in the area. China have denied that the manoeuvre was dangerous and demanded that the US end patrols of the South China Sea. And Isabel Hilton, the US will obviously do that, won't they?
I'm sure they've called them all off as of now, as they did after 2001 when the Chinese managed to collide with a US spy plane flying at 22,000 feet and caused a forced landing, losing one of their own in the course of it. So the Chinese certainly have form on this. And they captured 22 crew from that 2001 episode, dismantled the plane, inspected it thoroughly, and shipped the bits back eventually.
It was one of those stories that oddly sort of, well, I mean, it disappeared, you know, because obviously then 9/11 happened and there were sort of more important, urgent Indeed. Things to consider. But there was a moment, wasn't there, when that happened, where it looks actually quite tense.
It was pretty tense.
Because there was a new president as well under George W. Bush.
It was George W.'s first foreign policy problem. And there was a massive, you know, kind of rallying of American sentiment around our boys, you know, captured by the wicked Chinese and so on and so forth. And it was a pretty tense incident. They had, you know, been descending slowly through, you know, not as slowly as they'd like, you know, trying to trash the electronics and the intelligence on board before they actually were forced to land at Hainan. They were getting no help from the tower in Hainan, so they were, you know, it could have been a lot worse. And after that, the Americans and the Chinese did negotiate a set of protocols about this kind of thing, which have operated fairly well. The Chinese backed off in terms of the shock drop tactics. So we haven't had any dangerous incidents, though we've had an escalating tension over both maritime patrols and over overflights, which are to do with the Chinese claims in the South China Sea and a certain number of things that are coming to a head quite soon. So there's the Philippines case at the tribunal on the Convention of the Law of the Sea, which is coming up. That doesn't seem to be going very well for China. And we have the US president about to visit Vietnam and Japan, who are both, of course, have maritime difficulties with China right now, Vietnam particularly, over the South China Sea. So, you know, you've got the Chinese elbowing and trying to demonstrate to their neighbors, or rather disaffected right now, that they can't rely on the United States and the United States will eventually have to back off defending smaller countries in that a part of the Chinese backyard. But it's a dangerous game.
Martin Plaut, the US under Obama, but certainly under Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State in the US, made a big claim that they wanted to pivot to Asia. And they've somewhat struggled with that because there's been lots of other crises for them to deal with. But there is this issue, isn't there, as Isabel suggests, that for a number of nations in that region that are worried about China, they're not entirely convinced 100% that the US will always have its back.
Well, yes, and who would worry them? I mean, you know, the Americans tend to, of course, in the end, go with America's own interests rather than anyone else's. But you know, I just remember going to Vietnam many years ago and speaking to some of the elderly people who'd fought the French and then had fought the Americans during their war of independence, you know, and trying to reunite the country. And I talked to them about it. In the end, they turned to me and said, you know, all of this is just small fry. In the end, our eternal enemy are the Chinese. And, you know, that is very much their perspective. And everybody looks at the Chinese and worries, and, you know, in the region. And, you know, the problem is how far are all these nations going to push this in order to, frankly, win their case in other means? As you say, the Philippines are now have one in the courts. Well, you know, would the Chinese recognize the jurisdiction of the courts?
Well, indeed,
they haven't recognized it. But no, but they have produced a response to the Philippines case without acknowledging the jurisdiction of the court. And oddly enough, they've
got very Chinese.
Indeed, it's very Chinese. It's even more Chinese because there's another dispute over a rock with Japan, in which they argue against the Japanese that particular rock being covered at high tide gives them no territorial claims. Whilst in the South China Sea, you know, building on very, very similar rocks, but building very elaborate structures on similar rocks, which are clearly military, so that they have this salami slicing tactic. They sink fishing boats, not military boats. They don't give anyone an excuse, really, for a conflict. So the closest we get are the Americans' insistence on protecting freedom of passage, and that's what this particular issue is about.
Okay, we're going to end today by talking about Canada, a country that, unlike South Africa, perhaps isn't known for its raucous politics. But there was a bit of an altercation, shall we say, in the House of Commons in Ottawa yesterday. Let's have a listen to this.
He elbowed the member from Earthian Mascot.
And
Mr. Speaker, he manhandled the whip of the official opposition. Physical force in this house is never permitted, is never welcome, and it is entirely inappropriate.
Not only was this the furthest thing from a feminist act.
I was elbowed in the chest by the Prime Minister, and then I had to leave. It was very overwhelming, and so I left the chamber to go and sit into the lobby. I missed the vote because of this.
I want to take the opportunity to be able to express directly to her my apologies for my behaviour and my actions, unreservedly.
So, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has had to apologise after he was accused of manhandling an opposition MP during a debate on assisted dying. Martin Platt, is not exactly what we expect from Canadian politics, but has it been slightly blown out of proportion?
Well, it would be hard to say that there was a storm in a teacup, since I think it's actually a storm in a thimble. It is below visibility. I mean, I have seen, you know, more robust events on the tube in London, the Underground. You know, you get shoved around, you know, by ordinary people in the everyday commute. This was nothing. It was below visibility. I mean, compared with what happened in South Africa, you know, where blows were thrown and all the rest of it, that was a full brawl. Glass plate, glass windows were broken, all the rest of it. I mean, this was absolutely nothing. I just don't know how they managed to get their knickers in a twist about it.
Canada as well has a little way to go before it reaches the heights of Taiwan or South Korea.
Absolutely, yes. I think
Ukraine.
Not even close. I mean, I did see one quote from a no doubt pompous politician saying this was, you know, the most outrageous incident in Canada's history. Well, you know, I know things are dull in Canada, but I can't believe I can't believe that nothing more exciting has happened in, you know, the last 400 years.
is it fair though to say, Martin, that perhaps a little bit of the sheen on Justin Trudeau has worn off in recent weeks from, you know, being accused of being a little too smug with his little videos about the Invictus Games, to incidents like this where, you know, whatever you make of the seriousness or not, you know, he clearly lost his temper during a debate in Parliament, showed it. You see him striding across in a really, you know, Parliament in a really foul mood, and has to make quite a fulsome apology afterwards.
Well, big deal. People lose their temper in Parliament. I mean, you know, for goodness sake, just down the road, Michael Heseltine picked up the mace and whirled it around his head in Parliament. You know, this is a bit more like it. What on earth? I just don't get it. You know, the worst thing that's ever happened in Canada, I mean, the assault on the Heights of Abraham when the British threw the French out, does that not rate a bit higher? I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't understand Canadian politics. I really shouldn't be discussing this at all.
Brilliant. Well, I, for one, am looking forward to emails from Canadian listeners. Martin Plout and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much indeed. But I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mary Justi and Faith Barker. Toby Hammond was the man behind the glass. We've got a bit of music next, and then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Do stay tuned for that. Also, if you're in London, do look out for The Urbanist Live. Go to monocle.com. You can find tickets for The Urbanist Live, our first ever live studio audience show. That's coming up very, very soon. Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.